So, again, lesson four. I don't think... Lesson four, Job, examining power. Okay. So, just as a quick review, we're going to go through the review. I'm not going to take the lesson.
But using it too. This is a different recorder. I think she's using
it. But it's going. Okay. I can see that. Well, you'll see where we're going to go with this today. I'm kind of excited because I get to show you a clip that I just love. Hopefully that works. But let's review really quickly. We talked about God's perichoretic nature, this thing, right? This is how God is. That's his being. And that it is indicative of an outward mindset, which means he's always for the other and always receiving the other. God is for us. That is the basic of what you should be getting out of Genesis 1 and 2. That is a foundational premise for God's people. God is for us. Because God is for us, he gave us the gift of being able to choose for ourselves a mindset. Either his mindset, being for others, or an inward mindset, being for ourselves. And he gives us that choice. So that when we get to Job, the purpose of Job is to help us to think rightly about God. Because when we think rightly about God, we'll think rightly about ourselves, our circumstances, and others. That's where Job is going. I think it's been really interesting to hear comments. I've gotten more comments from Job than any other book I've ever taught.
Artist.
And that's where I'm getting is, it's hard. You have to think so much. I'm not sure I like thinking so much. I'm struggling. I can't see how this is. So the interesting thing is, of course, for me, it feels like a lot of pushback. And so I also have to struggle with, okay, God, you want me to keep going with this. This is harder than I thought. But I do think that when we get to the end, you will have recognized how important it is that we think about our theology. So many times I think in the church as lay people, we don't think theology is important. And I will beg to differ. I think theology is extremely important, and I think we all have really messed up theologies that really mess up how we respond to life. So I actually think the book of Job is really important, and I think thinking deeply and learning to think deeply and learning to practice that with one another in our conversations is more important than we realize. And so as much as I'm getting a lot of pushback, and I'm not always hearing it directly, sometimes indirectly.
You get it from your husband too, don't you?
And I get it from my husband as well. I think this is just so important for us that we are able to live as image bearers who reflect accurately who God is. So we need to determine and expose and let God expose our wrong thinking so that we get there. And it doesn't mean that you're going to easily come up with answers. I think today's discussion, I think, was the hardest. I listened to all of you, and you're all struggling with what does Job want out of this debate, and what does that say about God, how Job thinks about God. Interesting to hear the conversation. So hopefully today we'll get a little bit of understanding where that's going. The book of Job has an intentional design. We know that its rhetorical strategy is to expose wrong thinking, right, and examine it. Expose the thinking. What are you thinking? Where are you putting all your trust? And examine that. Is that good? Is that proper? Does that lead us to life as God has intended? And then to reject any wrong thinking and replace it with right thinking. And then to present and practice actions that correspond and are coherent with right thinking. So that's the rhetorical strategy of Job. It's also my strategy in you doing the homework, in examining your own thoughts, in doing the conversations in groups. All of that is the same strategy that the author of Job is doing or using. Job is a literary construct. As far as it uses the characters in the story as with roles, it assigns them roles and they have function. The function of Job is to be the star witness. The function of Hasatan is to challenge and scrutinize God's policies to see if there are any weaknesses. And God, of course, plays the role of defending his policy by using one of his image bearers. The challenge that we are first introduced to is the challenge by Hasatan, and that is, does Job fear God for nothing? We're going to add to that challenge next week. And that is tested by taking away Job's benefits. And then the witnesses encompass the wisdom of the world. So we talked about examining theologies, the great symbiosis versus the retribution principle, and noticing that they often get combined. If you were to give me a very simple sentence that described what the great symbiosis was, what would you say? How would you describe that? How would you describe the theology of the great symbiosis?
God's not fair. Transaction.
Yeah, everything's a transaction.
Transaction.
That's basically the idea of the great symbiosis. Everything's a transaction. It is not about relationship, it's about transaction. The gods need you to do some stuff for them, we'll do the stuff for them, so you'll protect us. That's the great symbiosis. The retribution principle, on the other hand, actually looks a lot like that. Right, in some form, it still feels very transactional, right? But in a different form. So, how would you describe the retribution principle? This is Israel's theology.
The good is blessed, and the wicked accursed.
Yep. So that's basically the retribution principle. Israel, of course, expands that to its corollary. And what's the corollary?
If you're cursed, you must be evil. If you're blessed, you must be good.
Yes, exactly. So that's the retribution principle that we're working under in Job, because Israel expanded it to its corollary. And not just Israel, but all of us expanded to its corollary. So what you notice in these two theologies is they often get intermingled, right? And even today within the Christian church, we use these as premises, and we intermingle those as well. When you look at that just subjectively, one is supposed to represent the world. That would be the great symbiosis, the world's thinking. And the retribution principle is Israel's thinking. And so we can even extrapolate that and say, today, the great symbiosis is still the world's thinking. And the retribution principle is still the church's thinking. And we mix it up with the world's, with the great symbiosis, and we use the corollary. So this is, as much as this is an ancient text, it is absolutely right on target for today. Hopefully you're getting that. You're getting all the thinking that goes through in each of these. Using these, either one, as a foundational premise, or combining them two, is where we come up with our flaws in thinking about God. If we use those as foundational premises. The three flaws that Job talks about are viewing God as petty, thinking that God is expecting too much, because we value our needs and desires over God's consistent character. The reality is his attributes are manifested appropriately and proportionately to what is needed. None of his attributes trump any of the others. Hopefully this is all review for you. The second flaw is assessing God based on logic. In other words, our philosophy of how we think the world should work. Those are our philosophies. We think the world should work, and almost all of us think the world should work by justice. Retribution principle. And so we then judge God based on that, which is exactly what Job is doing, right? The world should work by this way, and this is how God's word. God is not blessing me. Therefore, God must be what?
Wrong.
God's wrong. That's where we were going with the question today. Job is saying God has to be wrong. Because he's not blessing me. He's not working according to the retribution principle. It's broken, and the broken piece is not me, right? That's what Job says. It can't be me, because I know I'm righteous. I know I'm keeping. And it can't be the retribution principle, because that's the basic for life. So it must be God. God is wrong. So that's what happens when you assess God based on your philosophy, either your picture or your system. Because we value our philosophy over theology. How many times would you rather talk about your philosophy of life, how you think life works, than theology? if you're just standing in a room of your neighbors, right? We're going to talk, because theology, all of a sudden we kind of go, I'm not sure I want to talk there, right? One of the reasons is because we don't know our theology well enough. And in Job, you should be able to come out with a better theology and stop depending on a philosophy of life. Reality is God's revelation of himself, which should be the basis of our theology, is what helps shape our understanding of our experiences, not the other way around. And that's what's happening with Job, right? He's using his experience to shape how he feels like the world works and how God works, rather than how does God work? Oh, God works this way. That should shape how I see my experience. Does that, are you beginning to understand what's going on for Job? He's wrestling all right, but at this point right now, he feels God's just wrong, because I know I'm not wrong, and I know that RP is the way it goes. See, he's not questioning yet the philosophy. The third flaw is embracing practical deism. We think God has created the world and stepped back to let it run its own. I think this is actually the most pervasive one. And I think we don't even realize how much we believe this. We value knowing the mechanics of the natural world rather than valuing how God is acting, that God's activity is going on. It's much easier for us to say, well, this is how God placed it, and now it works just the way he placed it, rather than say God is intimately involved moment by moment.
He's in control.
He's in control. But we like to think of a control as he placed it and then walked away. But it's in control all the time, right? And that's the place where all the friends, not the friends so much, but Job, is. He says he believes that. I do believe God is in control moment by moment. Otherwise, he wouldn't be going back and forth with God.
Aaron. If he wasn't in control, people wouldn't pray about changing the course. I heard on 700 Club, I heard Pat mention we prayed against that storm, that it wouldn't come in and take away all the stuff. So if he didn't really believe that God was in control, why pray?
Right, and that's what I'm saying. Job wouldn't be where he is if he didn't believe that God was in control of all the little things. Yeah. So the reality is that God's wisdom and power govern the cosmos moment by moment. Last week, we examined hope. Hope is that which we believe is fundamentally true enough to wait for. And hope leads to trust, a willingness to depend on the truth that we're waiting for. So hope is believing enough to wait for it, and trust is depending our life on it. Do you see that they go together? You can't separate the two. It's a journey of those two. Hope will be tested, and it will be tested in order to expose whether we have any hope in a system. Because if I have a hope in a system, my loyalty is going to be to the system. It's also tested to expose if we have any hope in a picture of God, in our own made-up picture of God, or a picture that someone's handed to us. And that's going to require loyalty to the picture. Hope will also be tested in order to build true hope in God alone. I hope you're noticing the words of the song we sing every time. It incorporates all of this idea. And it says, our hope is in Lord, not in how we picture the Lord, but how he reveals himself, not in the systems that God has given throughout, but in God himself. When we build our hope in God, it's going to require us giving up our expectations. We don't get to outline God. It also requires us to yield to expectancy of God's good. God has told us he's good. That is where our hope is. He's good. I don't know what the good looks like, and I can't determine the good, which is all what Genesis 3 was about, right? They wanting to determine what is good. Do you think you struggle with that? I want to determine what's good, right? I want to say, this is good and this is not good. And God says, that's my right. I get to do that. You depend on me being good. it propels us then into a journey where we will recognize what God means by relationship. So we enter today then, and we're going to examine power. And every one of the testimonies will talk about power, how God uses power, and how they see it. And you will notice that each of them decide how God uses power by what they believe in, by what they trust in. Either there's the system for the friends or the picture for Job. And that's what determines for them how God uses his power. And so we're going to examine what they see about that, and then we're going to get a little bit toward the end. Job is beginning to have just a little bit of doubt. So we'll see that. So Eliphaz, in chapter 22, his view of God. His view of God is that God is powerful and remote. In other words, because he's powerful, that keeps him distant. He's too important to relate to people. He's busy keeping the order of the retribution principle. In other words, God's power is used to make sure the retribution principle is stable. Because remember, what is, as far as Israel is concerned, what do they think God's most important attribute is?
Justice.
Justice. That's how God runs the world, by justice. That's what they feel. That's what they believe. And so that's where he puts all his power to, is to make sure that things are run by justice. And so this is how Eliphaz thinks, he's so consumed with making sure that everything is just that he has to stay remote from everything else. He's got to be, right, because what do we say in America? Justice is
blind,
right? So I've got to have a distance. That's how Eliphaz feels, because in order for him to make sure that justice is done, he's got to have this remoteness from him, from man. Eliphaz begins to explain his philosophy and his view of God by asking Job two questions. And the first question is, I'm going to read you what the translation has, and then I'm going to tell you a better translation without having to go through all the... This is the one thing about Job. We could spend each session on one sentence, because to pull apart all the Hebrew and the syntax, I don't think you're really interested in that. Diane says, no. So I'll just give you what that would look like. So 22:1, Eliphaz asks Job, can a vigorous man be of use to God, or a wise man be useful to himself? All right, let's pull that apart. What he's really asking is, will a mediator, a vigorous man, I can go so many places on this. I would love to, but a mediator, what Job is asking for. Well, what you're asking for, this mediator, will it do any good in a case against God? Will it be useful? So that's the first question he asks Job. And what he's doing, what Eliphaz is doing, is he's using Job's desired course, right? And his desired course is to, look, I'm going to deny my wrongdoing, I'm going to request a mediator, and I'm going to demand that God appear in court. That's what Job has wanted to do. And so Eliphaz is using that to explain God to him. And we do this a lot, right? We'll ask questions. Do you think that's going to help? Do you think you demanding God to come to court is going to help? Don't you know that God is powerful and that he's busy making sure that the retribution principle is in place? You think this is going to do any good? Because God's using his power not to come to court with you, but to make sure that justice is done everywhere. So that even if you brought a skillful negotiator, and he says some man here, but we also know that Job thinks it's going to be from the divine council, which is why we have vigorous man, this being that could be from the divine council, but it could also be a man, this, right, paradoxical. Could a mediator do you any good? Don't you know where God's power is? It's all about keeping the retribution principle aligned. The interesting thing about the question from Eliphaz to Job is, well, actually a mediator has been, from the divine council, has been employed, right, by God to take God to, not to court, but to say, well, God, is your policy good or not? And how has that ended up for Job? Not so good, right? Now, Job doesn't know this, but the reader should be laughing at this. The reader should go, Job, it's not going to work. Not because of Eliphaz's argument, because God is too distant. Actually, God is paying close attention, right? He's already signed a mediator, and the mediator is using Job, and Job is suffering because of that. What I want you to start noticing in 22 all the way through 27 is the word Almighty. All of a sudden, the witnesses and Job are starting to describe God as Almighty. And that's because right now they're examining the power of God. How is the power of God used? And you'll see it over and over and over again, more so than any other section. The other reason that Eliphaz asked that question is not just because God's power is being used to maintain the justice of the RP, but because God is too remote. He's even remote from the angels. And we get that from verse 12, where it says God is in the height of heaven. God is not just in the heaven, but he's in the height of heaven. So he's separated even from his angels. So because he's busy, he's a busy man. So Eliphaz is picturing him as if he's a CEO of a corporation who has, right, the top penthouse office. And his top advisors don't occupy that floor. They occupy another. So to think the peons down here could have access is ridiculous, right? That's what Eliphaz is saying. Now, from Job's experience, it almost seems like that might be true, that God is distant, right? I think this group here was talking about how much God is hidden from him, that he can't find God anywhere. And so Job is listening to this argument thinking, well, that seems true. Like, he's just so distant. But he knows, because he's had experience with God in relationship, that God can be near. He just doesn't know why he isn't near now. But let's think about the first readers to this book of Job. The first readers to this book of Job are Israel, right? And Israel knows that's not the truth, that God is not remote. Mm-hmm. How does Israel know that God is not remote?
He's led them.
Right, he's led them. He's made them a people. In fact, because of covenant, God is obviously near, right? What does covenant say to them? I will be your God and you will be my people, and I will lead you and I will bring you to a place where we will live together. So Israel, reading this, goes, that's not true, Eliphaz. God is near. We are the evidence that we are a people of God whom God lives with. We are the evidence that God is near, so that can't be true. And so even though Job feels like that's true, Israel, reading this, says, well, that isn't true. What about you as a part of the church, the body of Christ? Do we have evidence that that is not true? That God is not remote?
Of course.
What's our evidence?
We have the Holy Spirit.
Okay, but even before that, so let's go from the very beginning of the church. What evidence do we have that God is not remote?
Jesus came and lived with them.
Okay, so number one, incarnation, right? Mm-hmm. Incarnation, what is it? What is actually the three words that mean incarnation?
God with us.
Emmanuel. We know that God came to live with us in flesh, right? That his word became flesh. But in his death, we also know that God took on our suffering, to live our suffering for us and do something with that. And then with his resurrection, it isn't just that God lived with us or that God lived for us, but also that God lives in us. So as the church reading this, we know that that is absolutely not true. God is not remote. And so, of course, Job doesn't know these things yet, but he's going to get there, right? So that's where we're looking at those ideas here. So if we were to answer Eliphaz, his question, We would have to answer it. Is it, does it mean you're going to do any good? We'd have to answer it with a qualified yes, right? Yes, a mediator, a man from heaven, will do us good. But not in the way Job wants, right? Because Job wants an advocate to proclaim him innocent. And if Job is proclaimed innocent, who's proclaimed guilty?
God.
That's not the kind of mediator we have. And we're not going to be vindicated in the way Job wants to be vindicated. We're not going to be declared innocent. We're going to be declared in Christ righteous with him, his righteousness. So what this does is it sets the foundation for the reader to say, okay, Job isn't going to get the mediator he wants. But it sounds like there could be possibly a mediator that could help. The reader doesn't know what that looks like yet, but it sets the possibility on the table. There could maybe be a mediator that could do us good. That's not going to vindicate us, but it's going to some mediator that's doing good. So a lot of Job has a lot of these tiny little, like little trails, you know, like Hansel and Gretel leaving those little breadcrumbs. There's just these little breadcrumbs all throughout Job that you'll find. It never comes out with, yes, there will be a mediator. There will be somebody who is a man God that does this. It just leaves little crumbs so that the reader says, I got to know more. I got to keep going, right? I've got to go on beyond and see that. And that's one of the pieces where there's a breadcrumb. The second question Eliphaz asks is there any pleasure to the Almighty if you are righteous, or profit if you make your ways perfect? Okay, so it's kind of, the way they translate it in English kind of flipped the syntax. So here's what it looks like. Will God be pleased that you justify yourself at his expense? And he is, right? If I'm asking for justification that I'm right, then it's at God's expense because it means he's wrong. So of course, I mean, that one doesn't even need a lot of examination, right? Do you think God would ever be pleased at us justifying ourselves at his expense, right? And I did hear some discussion on this, thinking, well, what does that look like? It means when I say, and I have said this, God, why are you doing this to me? I've done everything right. And I have said that, and I have said that out loud to him. That is a point where I'm trying to justify myself at God's expense. God, I've done everything right. Why are you wrong here? What are you doing? Don't you know you're doing something wrong? I mean, it's ridiculous, right, when you say that? And yet, how many of you can honestly say you have said that to God? Right? If you have been through some really, really hard suffering, I can pretty much guarantee you have said that. Even if you're not honest enough with yourself to say that, you have probably said that. Hopefully you know that because you then can identify with Job and take his journey as well. That's where Job is. And Eliphaz is right in this. Is God going to be pleased? Absolutely not. Only a flawed view of God is going to allow you to think that that's okay. Right? A flawed view of God to think that God could ever be wrong. I really struggled with the music I wanted to use for our opening song. And the one that kept coming over and over again, and I didn't use it because it has too many gaps, too many silences, it's just hard to do as a group, is that old Babby Mason song. I'm trying to think of what the name of it is. If you can't understand what's going on, trust his heart. What is that called? Do you know that song? Really? Okay. I'm going to have to bring it up. It's this idea of if we can't understand it, God must be wrong, right? If it doesn't make sense to us, God must be wrong. And in the song, she sings, if you can't understand it, trust that he actually knows what's going on. You don't have to. And that's where we're going to find with Job. Chris.
I was just going to confess, I did exactly that where I justified myself this morning. I had an accident on Saturday. And as I was driving here, I was really nervous about driving because I had to go right through the same spot. And right where it happened, the light turned red. And I immediately thought, really, God? Because I was nervous.
thank you, Chris, because that really illustrates. That's so funny because literally this morning I did the exact same thing. I did the coffee wrong. Actually, see, I was going to blame somebody else. And it went all over everything. And I was already late. I pulled it. I said, really, God? Today? Yeah. Again. See, we do this all the time without even thinking. And that's why examining our thinking brings us back to, wow, I'm always blaming God. I'm always saying he's in the wrong when things don't go the way I picture them, right?
Because we always think he's for us, he's for us, he's for us, right?
Right. And so for us, he's for us means everything goes right.
For us by our guidelines.
Yeah, right. Here's the boundary of what it means to be for us, God. Fit into that. Right? And it definitely wasn't having an accident or spilling the coffee everywhere or a million little things, let alone a million big things, right? All those really hard things that can't possibly be for us.
Jonathan,
yeah.
What you think about people who have really, really suffered, or those that have lost children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard for me to wrap my head around that. You know, that, yeah, they want to blame God and they want to see God as wrong, because what else can they do? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, that wasn't my plan to lose a child,
mm-hmm.
you know, mm-hmm. or to lose someone that you're close to in your family. But that kind of suffering, it's really hard to trust God in that.
It is really hard. I agree. And this is where I always struggle, because most of you know the hard stuff I've been through, and it was pretty hard. I don't share it on tape. I agree it's hard. But if we begin to think about who God is and how he uses his power, it will bring us to a new place in life. So when we get through this, I think Job, one of Job's last things, is so powerful for us to be able to stand back and go, oh, maybe I don't understand what's going on. And that's the point where we need to get to. Not understanding, but saying, I don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a place of real freedom. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where we're going. Yep.
So hard, but the alternative is even harder.
Worse. Yes.
You know, just to
yes.
be like, hopeless and think there's no purpose or
yes, yes,
nothing
exactly.
going on that we don't understand.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Nobody. Why would you want to worship a God that you can figure out and understand?
That's right.
Like, you know.
Right. He wouldn't be God. Right. He would not be a God. Yeah. So the answer to Eliphaz's question: will God be pleased that you justify yourself at his expense? No, I don't think we have to examine that too much, except to say we do it all the time. We construct our own perception of how God should work, and when we don't, we blame him for not working that way. We blame him for not fitting into our outline of what he should be, which means we set up ourselves as the authority. The view of Job: Eliphaz accuses him of being unjust. And he has specific indictments of Job's injustice. In 22:6-9, he says that Job oppresses the hungry, he oppresses the widow, the orphans, and the debtors. Which is funny, because all of a sudden you're like, what? How does he know that?
Yeah.
Well, here's where it comes from for Eliphaz. Meeting the needy of the vulnerable, specifically those who are hungry, the widows, the orphans, and the debtors. That was actually the expected obligation of everybody in an A&E society. That was expected in order to make sure that order was maintained in life. So A&E society, not just Israel society, all A&E society said, we are obligated as citizens of the world to meet the needs of the widows, the orphans, the poor, the debtors. We're actually obligated. Interesting, isn't it, that all the way, ancient times, all people, all cultures believed that that was our obligation in a society, because that would keep order.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are in today in society where we don't believe that anymore. We don't believe that that is the expected norm of everybody. But the interesting, so that's why Eliphaz can use that as a charge. Well, you're suffering, so you must not be taking on your personal obligation. And your personal obligation is to make sure that everything's ordering, so that all of us have this personal obligation to make sure that, the world is ordered. And the way we do that is to make sure that the vulnerable are have their needs met. And so, really, this is why Eliphaz is really upset. Like, you are disturbing the order of the world here. You're disturbing our peace because you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. The other thing is, he doesn't have any specific evidence of this because these are all private offenses, right? These are not public offenses. It's not that Job hasn't set up a program for the poor. He hasn't individually met the needs of the poor that he's seen. And these offenses are private. They're between individuals. And because they're between individuals of different status, right? Job is rich. He's got everything. The vulnerable have nothing. The vulnerable also are victims who have no voice. So they can't say whether... There's no way someone poor would ever accuse someone rich in A&E society. They wouldn't be heard. They had no voice. So Eliphaz is on pretty solid ground here because he figures, well, of course this is what he's done, because he's upsetting the order, right? He's upsetting my order. And nobody ever proved that he isn't doing that because the victims aren't going to come forward. So he feels pretty confident that he can say that this is the sin that Job has committed, that he hasn't met the needs of the vulnerable. Does that make sense? So that's why he's accusing him of that. He needs now, like he's already losing his argument, and he needs something specific now. And he's like going, oh, I could use this. I could say, you have oppressed the widow. And it's Job's words against his. I have not oppressed the widow. Well, do you think a widow that you've oppressed is going to come up and say that to you? You see that? So that's why Eliphaz can use that. So his advice to Job is, yield and be at peace. I'm 21. Yield. What he means by yield is pay attention to God. Give God space to make sure that the RP is working. Let him use his power to uphold the RP. You're crowding in on him. And stop arguing. Be at peace. Stop arguing with God. Plead guilty to the charges and let God go about the business of keeping the RP in order. Because order was the most important thing to the A&E world. That everything is working and in order, because it's the way we can have peace in our lives, right? Isn't that how you feel in your house?
Yes.
Right? Yes. Yes, Angela. Yes. If everything's in order, and order may mean different to you than it does to me, right? I'm looking for Kim. Where's Kim?
She was just here.
She's in the bathroom.
When I think about how Kim sees order and I see order, we see order differently, right? We see it very differently. So order in my house is going to look different than order in Kim's house. Kim's laughing.
You missed a little bit when you walked in.
It's going to look different. But if you're going to disturb my order, I'm going to have to get at you, right? You're disturbing my order. I won't ever question, is my order really order? That's what's happening with Eliphaz, right? He can't even entertain that because he's loyal to the RP order. So he's not going to entertain that. So he's saying, stop arguing, plead guilty. Let's get back to order here. Let God worry about the RP and stop taking him out of being attentive to the RP. But that is not Job's idea of engaging with God. For Job, he feels he would jeopardize his integrity if he's to plead guilty to something he hasn't done, right? So to him, that's disorder. Do you see that? They're seeing disorder in two different ways. If I say, I'm sorry, I'm guilty, how many times have you been, okay, so when I was in an accident and I didn't know what to do and I went and, like, we both got tickets, one ran a red light and I was in an intersection, waiting at an intersection, which is illegal. Didn't know it. Doesn't matter. You're still guilty. So, of course, I pled guilty. And afterwards, when I got sued by the person who ran the red light, my lawyer said, why did you plead guilty? And I said, because I was. And they said, oh, you've just messed up your whole case.
What?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Yeah, because you're admitting.
Yes, Yeah, right, exactly, yeah. Exactly. That's what Job is feeling. Mm-hmm. Wait, no, I can't plead guilty here to something I didn't do. That doesn't hold up my order, the order that I see. Get it?
Yes.
Okay. So, Eliphaz says, if you take my advice, if you just stop arguing, plead guilty, we can get order back to... What will happen is not only will my order be restored, but Job, he'll get power from this. All this time he's been saying you'll have restored possessions, right? You'll get your riches back. And now he's saying your power is going to be restored. You're going to have influence now. What does he mean by that? This is so interesting. He says you'll have restored favor with God. So you'll be able to be in a position to influence God for others. So that when others come into this position, where they're charged as guilty, but they're innocent, you can say from your experience, advise them, oh, just plead guilty, everything will be okay, and now God will take away all the suffering. So Eliphaz is saying, you're going to actually have power here to influence God, to take away the suffering of others who perhaps have not pled guilty yet. Because you can say, oh, all you need to do is to plead guilty. You see that? You see what kind of power? And interesting that Eliphaz has taken one more tact. He's like, well, I don't know what's wrong with this Job. He doesn't want his possessions back. Ah, I know one thing. Power. We all want power. And of course, so last night I sat down, just looked at the magazines that came in the mail, and there was this is an addition to Christianity Today. It's for pastors. And the first article I saw was Seduced by Power. Mm-hmm. And it is five different pastors talking about how they've been seduced by power. Mm-hmm. Right in the church. Mm-hmm. He says, the first one says, God took me on a journey into the truth of my heart, using failure to expose my desire for power. Very interesting. I mean, I won't read it all, but there's lots of all these pastors. This is how I am seduced by power, to influence others, to influence God. Very interesting. And I love that pastors are writing this. Because we do tend to put them up here and realize, oh, we're all seduced by power. Mm-hmm. And power can look different ways, right? It can be influence with friends. It can be respect. It can be reputation, whatever that is. Eliphaz knows he's seduced by power, so Job probably is. He wants Job then to focus on himself so that order comes, so that Eliphaz himself can finally, the RP does work. Good. What I've depended my life on, still intact. Eliphaz is actually arguing for himself, but of course he doesn't see that. But Job says, I don't want to just focus on me. I want to look at the injustice in the world all along. It's not just injustice to me, but there's injustice in where God is not looking as well. So they're at crosses with each other. They're not going to agree. So that's Eliphaz. We then get to Bildad. And I bet you, 25 is only like 60. Yeah. Only 6 words, really short. What we see is, this is the last of the speeches. And they are running short of any more arguments. And so Eliphaz, like I said, changes his tactic. Well, maybe I have not caught Job yet. Maybe I can do so by tempting him to power. Bildad is like, I don't have anything to say but platitudes. The brevity of his speech tells us he doesn't have any more arguments left. He really doesn't have any more to say to persuade Job. And actually, he doesn't think Job's worth it, as we see at the end of what he thinks of humanity. So he doesn't even give him advice. He just pontificates on his views. His view is that God is unimaginably great, powerful. And because of that, humans are of little consequence to God. Because they're intrinsically flawed. And so he again says, God uses his dominion, his power, he rules to establish peace. And how, what does peace mean for Bildad? The order of the RP. That's what God uses his power for, is to establish order according to the RP. And Bildad, like Eliphaz, understands that God's power is really for his benefit, or all our benefits, just to make sure to maintain order. It's just like, let's say there's argument at the Thanksgiving table. And what are most of your thoughts? Okay, people are arguing at the Thanksgiving table. What am I going to do?
Change the subject,
right? Because I just want to, let's keep the peace. That's what Bildad is doing. Let's just keep the peace. Because, look, I don't like this order disturbed, right? And Job is the one at the Thanksgiving table, and this has happened to me. The Thanksgiving table gets a little bit tense, and I think, oh, I can't deal with that. But there's always a Job there that says, no, wait a second, let's really get into that, right? Let's get there. And again, remember what I said, that wrestling is actually a good thing because you stay connected. Because and this is what I did the last time that ever happened. I got up and decided, oh, I need to clear off the table right now. Even though I never do that at Thanksgiving. That's not my job. So
Escape.
Bildad's view of Job is there isn't any possibility that he's just or righteous. But he's already exhausted all of his arguments. So he just resorts to platitudes. God is great and you're not. I don't know what you're doing. This weekend I went to a funeral, and it was really disturbing. It was a Christian man, great Christian man, but one of his loved ones got up to speak, and she had only platitudes. I'm pretty sure she's not a believer, and she kept saying over and over. I mean, she must have said it 15 times. If we just keep him in our hearts, he will not be dead. If we just keep his name alive, he will not be dead. She said it over and over and over again. And I kept thinking of Bildad. You only have platitudes to go by. And you say it over and over again as if saying it over and over again will make it true. And I just felt horrible. Like, no, what are you, I mean, that's absolutely not true. That doesn't make a person alive. But if I have nothing else, that's what I cling to, right? I'm going to cling to, if I just keep him in my heart, he's alive. That's the platitude way that Bildad is employing. Because there isn't a... Job cannot be righteous. Job cannot be righteous. That's what Bildad is saying. Job cannot be righteous. He cannot be righteous. God is good. You're inconsequential. Job cannot be righteous. Because the evidence from the RP is Job is not righteous. So it can't be any other way. I cannot think myself out of that. Because I'm so attached to my system. His implied result for Job is a really interesting sentence there. He calls basically man a worm or a maggot, right? He says, basically, you're going to die protecting your righteousness and it won't do you any good. And when he refers to worm or maggot, whenever the Andy people would use worm or maggot as a euphemism, it was always about the decay of death. Some definitions will actually talk about a certain worm, and I think it's called a scarlet worm, that when they are ready to produce eggs, they will attach themselves to a tree and never leave it. They will die there on that tree in order to protect the eggs. And so Bildad is saying, you're like this maggot. You're going to protect your righteousness no matter what, and you're going to die on that tree, and it's not going to do you any good. The scarlet worm that does that, supposedly when it does die, it releases its fluids, and its fluids are red, and they stain the tree around them, so that all is left is this red stain on a tree that marks the futility of the worm's life, supposedly. I personally think that's a stretch for that. I think worm has always been used as decay to death. So I think that's enough to be able to use that there. So that's Bildad's very short argument. I'm just going to give you platitudes because I can't imagine any other way, because I'm not going to question my system. So Job, you're going to die on that. Which is funny, is it's almost like the commentator is saying, Bildad, are you going to die on your system? Are you going to protect your system so much that you're going to die on that? There are so many of those times where the author is really using some irony that if you're reading it close enough, you'll see. I mean, there is so much of it there. So we get to Zophar. What does Zophar have to say? Nothing. Nothing. Remember, Zophar is the one who argues by logic, and logic's exhausted. Like, he's like, this is really what he's like, Job, I have nothing to say to you. Like, this is just logical, and why would you not do something logical? He was the one who first said, just confess. Get it over with so that you don't have to pay more. That's what he had said before, and now he's like, I don't know what to do with you. If you're not going to do that, I have nothing to say to you. So notice that all of the speeches have gotten shorter to the point of none for Zophar, because they've exhausted their arguments about Job just getting it over with, plead guilty, you are wicked, and go on.
Do a brain break.
Great.
Stand up. Take your right hand and tap a slow beat on your left thigh. Now tap your right foot to the ground at a faster pace than your right hand.
Oh gosh, that's really hard.
Once you have tried that for a while, try the other direction. So switch hands and feet. Can't do that. Okay. Tap opposite thighs with your hands and then tap both feet faster than you tap your hands.
No way.
No.
I can't do it. Thank you.
You're supposed to tap your feet together?
Yeah.
Whatever you can manage.
That's it.
Okay. Hopefully your brain is refreshed, because now we're going to get into the deep part. Job. Job 23 and 24 and 26. Job's view of God. God is unjust. God is wrong. Job is just, God is wrong. You are not just. And remember, that is the biggest thing for him, right? That justice is kept, that God is the keeper of justice. So God is unjust. And he's progressed from implying that God is unfair, which really is the same thing, but it sounds better, doesn't it? You're not fair, but you're not just. Here's the big deal for saying you're not just. Because justice is the ultimate good for an A&E person, right? If justice is the ultimate good, what is he basically saying about God?
You're not good.
You're not good. God, you're not good. So the accusation of God being unjust is really the accusation of God not being good. Why does he say this? He says this because this is the evidence that Job has that God is not good. He won't give him a fair hearing. He's denied him justice. If you're denying justice, you're not being just. Therefore, you're not good. Because God is not paying attention to the wicked. If you are allowing injustice, you're not being just. And therefore, you're not good. And here we're just going to pause and look at what Job says. He says, I'm wrestling, God, with the power that you allow the wicked to have to oppress people, and you don't even pay attention to them. You're allowing them to operate with oppression, with the power to oppress, without any punishment. And he categorizes this, because Eliphaz, remember, has accused him of being wicked because he has not met his social obligation to feed the poor. So he says, yes, I agree that is a wickedness, that people refusing their social obligations to keep order by oppressing the poor, the widow, the orphan, that's a wickedness. I agree. That's what he talks about in 2 through 12. That's who he's signifying. But he says there are other ways to be wicked. And from 13 to 19, he says, the other ways to be wicked are to operate in the dark. In other words, people who murder, people who are adulterers, and people who burglar houses. Those are all dark wickedness, people who operate in the dark. Does that make sense? But here's where it gets really interesting, because really this becomes an indictment of Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar. He says, there's a third way to be wicked, and that is to use positions of power to oppress and manipulate others. What do you think he thinks that the three wise men, the three friends, are doing to him? That's what they're doing, right? They're trying to manipulate him to confess guilt in order for their order to be okay. And they possess power because of their wisdom. So in the ancient times, wisdom was the most thing that gave power. Riches were because of your wisdom, all of these things. So in 22 through 23, all of your translations say God uses his power. But the word there is not God, it's he. And the translator, unfortunately, took that to mean God, and so capitalizes it, right? It either says God or capitalizes. It's not. It's referring to the wicked person. So let me read what it would say. He, a wicked person, uses his power to draw along the mighty. He rises to positions of influence, but his life is in constant jeopardy. Though he has provided for his own security, he has to keep his eyes on the mighty all the time. In other words, these wicked people, they rise to power and they use that power to manipulate others and to make their place secure. But in reality, it's not secure, right? Because when you're in that place and you've done it that way, what do you have to do? You got to watch your back, because it's going to happen to you, right? And that's what he's describing here. That's what Job is describing. So the wicked also are people who are in positions of power, and they use their power to manipulate others to keep their secure place. And really, this is an indictment against the three friends, as well as others. And he's almost saying, God, wait, you're making me suffer? What about the three friends here? They're trying to manipulate me into doing something wrong and keeping their order good, keeping their security well. So the third reason that he feels God is wrong, God is not good, is because God is making him to taste bitterness, because it is God who is causing his suffering. Those are the things that Job feels about God. So, of course, depending on our view of God, it will inform our view of ourselves. But all of that is informed by what we hold and depend on, what we trust. So Job's view of himself is he has committed to maintaining integrity. So do you see the juxtaposition? He says, God, you're not good, but I'm good. That's what's happening with Job. That's what's happened with all of those. Chris's great illustration. Really, God? I do not deserve this. I'm good. Why are you not being good? That's the idea here. Because as much as Job knows that the RP is broken, he still wants it to work. Right? We all do. Don't you want the RP to work?
Yeah.
Until you think deeply about it, right?
Yeah.
And then you realize, well, please don't employ the RP, because yeah, we would not be here. In the end, Job feels that his righteousness is going to be proven. So, see, he still believes that the RP is a good way to run the world. He knows he hasn't departed still from God's words. He's still kept his connection as much on his part. He's done good, but it is God who's actually dismayed him. It's God who has brought his sufferings, not his behavior. Again, this idea of, I'm good, I'm keeping the order. God's not. He's not keeping the order. Why isn't God upholding his part of keeping the order? Job says, I'm not going to be enticed by the power of the wicked, because that kind of power ultimately fails. So, he wants God to use his power to keep order. And for Job, order is respect my relationship with you by making my life blessed. But not because I want the blessing, because I want connection with you. Keep connected with me. Do your part in keeping order by keeping connected with me. So again, he is assuming that God is disconnected from him because he can't find him. We go all the way back to Genesis 3, right? There's a disconnection, and we don't know where he is. We go to the cross, and Jesus has to cry out, "Where are you? Where is God?" He's right there. So how does he view his friends? He views his friends as powerless. Remember, this is all about power. How do I see power? How is it used? He says the friends aren't even able to help the weak, which he considers himself right now, with their wisdom. So they are enemies, and they should be treated as wicked. So we're into 26 from here. His view of power, and this is where I feel, and lots of commentators would say, this next section, 26, 1 through 14, this hymn of Job about creation is one of the most powerful. But we have to take it apart a little piece by piece. Job's view of power, like the friends, is assessed by his own picture of personal order, right? And so he's going to say, I need to look at power. bless you. He looks at the power of the so-called wise. He feels it's useless. He addresses them in 1 through 4 very sarcastically, right? Somebody read just the first two sentences of 26, 1 and 2.
What a help you are to the weak. How have you saved the arm without strength? What counsel you have given to one without wisdom? What helpful insight you have abundantly provided? To whom have you uttered words? And whose spirit was expressed through you?
Now, is he saying this nicely?
No.
Sarcasm is dripping there. Dripping. Like, oh, you're so good at giving wise advice. No, he doesn't think that at all. This is hugely sarcastic here. He's saying your wisdom is useless to anybody. Your so-called power in your wisdom is void. There's nothing there. It doesn't help. You haven't helped restore my ordered relationship at all. It's ridiculous to even think about the fact that you have power in your words. And then he talks about the power of the wicked. While they certainly do seem to have power, he's looking around and he sees the power, the wicked have lots of power, that they have possessions, that they ignore God, and they still have children that run around and sing. But he says, he's already refused that, right? He says, I'm refusing that because I know it's actually temporary. Because I still believe that the RP is the best way to go, and that the RP is going to be fixed at some point. And we're going to see the wicked being punished for their wickedness. I feel like their power is temporary. I'm not at all tempted by that. And so I'm not going to give up my connection with God in order to get power that supposedly will influence God. It's going to be temporary. And then he contemplates the power of God. And this is the place where I want to just halt for just a few minutes. So some of the words in there, I think he uses, this is how we often read that. We read that section in 26, so 5 through like, I don't know where it goes to the 14. 5 through 14. We read that as if it is, and this we do all this time in the Old Testament, we read this and go, oh, it's talking about God hanging the earth in the midst of nothing. And we say, see, it's scientific stuff that we're talking about here. As if all of a sudden God is intersecting and saying, oh, the science that's going to be discovered in the 20th century, that we are a globe, that we are a sphere, and that we're hanging in the middle of nothing. That's what it sounds like, right, when you read that. I wish we could read it in Hebrew because it doesn't say that. And that's where it gets frustrating to think. We so much want to infuse what we know about today's world and fuse it there, like God's giving this secret prophecy about how the world really works. He's not. It doesn't say that. Some of the words used in there, basically this is a hymn about creation. And it is about the way that God created, and it goes all the way back to what we learned in Sabbath about God's creation. And what do we know? What did the ancients care about creation? Purpose, right? Function. Not how the material things came about or how we place things, but how he gave function to things, how he ordered. So creation in all Old Testament always talks about how God ordered the world, how he gave order to the world. And so the first couple verses where he talks about the waters for the above and the waters below, it's talking about, remember Genesis 1? That's we start with the waters, right? And he separates the water, right? So that he separates the waters and gives them boundaries for the purpose of having a place for heaven, having a place for the earth, and that there's a place below the earth, so that there's space for heaven and earth to come together. I mean, we could just teach Sabbath again to understand what he's talking about. Job is talking about ordering, that God is ordering the world, that God's power is used to create, to arrange function. So anytime we use creation, when we're talking Old Testament, we're always talking about assigning function, ordering the world. God's power is creative. God's power orders the world. It puts order into the world. If you were reading in Hebrew, you would know that he's talking about Genesis 1 because it uses all those words. Remember tohu and bohu about there being the emptiness. That emptiness is non-order. Remember we're talking about that? He takes non-order and he gives boundaries to non-order so that there's space for order. And that's what he's saying is, I'm taking non-order and I'm boundering there and here so that in the middle there's order. And when I created my image bearers, what did I say to them? Go and make space, more space, where there's more order, pushing those aside. In a minute, you'll understand why I'm explaining it this way. God's power then is creative. God's power creates order. This is what Job says there. When he goes on to verse 8, he says, God's power is directed by wisdom. Wisdom is the understanding of how things work so as to precisely and skillfully use power. So the idea behind wisdom is it gives a preciseness to power. It restrains power. And the first way he shows that is what happens with the clouds, right? He says he makes the clouds so that they envelop the rain so that they don't burst open all the time. So that he restrains his power. So that wisdom is that which targets the specifics because it knows how things work. In other words, think about wisdom as more of a laser beam trying to get out a cancerous cell rather than chemo drugs. You understand that, right? They're both powerful. Mm-hmm. Chemo drugs, very powerful, but they don't target, right? They annihilate everything. Whereas a laser takes all that power into one small space to get at that place and open up things. Does that make sense?
Yes.
That's what he says wisdom is doing. So wisdom is actually what directs power, God's power. So Job is beginning to contemplate God's power, and he doesn't feel like God is using his power right, but he's talking about how God, he's always got to go back to the very beginning where God's power is very evident. And he realizes that God's power in creation is actually very pointed. It's very used very skillfully to bring to one point so that it contains things or so that it gets to the exact point where it needs to rather than explode everything. That's what he's talking about with the cloud. And then he gets, I think, to the most. I love this verse, these couple of verses. God's power stirs up in order to make the seas. Remember, seas are always non-order. Seas in Old Testament are always non-order. When he stirs up the seas, he stirs up the seas in order to get them to retreat so that it exposes Rahab. Okay, a couple explanations there, right? So think about God stirring up the waters so that they recede, right? So that they part. And it will expose Rahab. Now, Rahab is a chaos creature. right? Which is one of the reasons the seas are non-ordered, because there's this non-ordered chaos creature stirring them up. And non-order means it has no function. And because it has no function, it doesn't work well in the world. And so he's trying to expose the non-order to excise it, right, to get it out. It's like you have a sliver in your hand. And one of the first things you do sometimes with a sliver in your hand is you want to expose it a little bit more, right? So a lot of times you'll put it in hot water, right, so that it opens the pores a little. I just read recently that's not true. It doesn't do that, but that's what we do. That's what I've always been told. So that it opens up and exposes that so that you can get into just, like, because you could just take a scalpel and cut the whole thing around, right, and have a nice big gouge, but the sliver is out. But that's not how God uses his power. He opens up, he disturbs those pores by taking hot water or taking the seas and splitting them so that now there's space so that now he can excise Rahab and take him out, or the sliver and take him out. Does that make sense to you? Yes? Am I losing somebody? Give me some indication here. Yes? Everybody with me there?
Yes.
Okay. So he's talking, when he talks about Rahab, Rahab is a chaos creature. Rahab also, so interesting, Rahab also is used to name Egypt. So sometimes, I wish I would have written them down. There are several, I wrote them somewhere and I don't have them on my notes. There are a couple places, I think, in the Psalms that say Egypt is Rahab. So it's not like we think this is what it is. It says it right there. So he also uses it for Egypt. So first readers, Israel, they're reading this. And he says how God does order in Genesis 1 is he stirs up the seas so that they recede to make space for him to get at Rahab so that he can excise Rahab out. Because Rahab is causing non-order to be an obstacle for that space where heaven and earth, where God and man can relate. Your first reader, you're Israel, you're reading this. What are you thinking?
The Red Sea.
The Red Sea. You're thinking the seas got stirred up and they receded into a wall. Now, we look at that and we think that's so cool. I'm going to walk through this dry land with these walls of water on my side. I'm sorry, guys, but if you're walking through a wall of water, you're terrified. You're absolutely terrified. This is chaos to you. This is not good to you. Why is God making us do this? Right? Why are these seas being stirred up to expose Rahab? And who's Rahab at this point for Israel thinking? Egypt, specifically Pharaoh, right? It's going to expose Pharaoh so that he can excise him. And what exactly happens? It's exactly what it does. It pulls Rahab right into the net, right? To kill him. So for the Israelite reading this, he's understanding that God's order sometimes looks like chaos because it stirs up the seas to make space for Rahab to show its face and for God to excise Rahab out. And for Israel, they're reading this going, oh yeah, that is what God did. That did feel like disorder. In fact, we really grumbled about that for days and months afterwards, and years. For 40 years, we grumbled about that. But God's order has a purpose. Even though God's order looks like chaos to us, looks frightening to us, that we have to walk through these kinds of waters. So that the power that God uses is directed by wisdom. And it makes sure that wisdom is a laser beam to draw out Rahab, out this non-order, out of the space that was created for man and God to relate. Let's take it one step further. Where do you think I'm going? What happens to Jesus on the cross? He's crucified. With what? What did we say about Jesus? He takes the power of God. What is, by the way, how does God create? What power does he use?
Word.
Thank you. Word. He takes his word and he opens up, he trembles, right? The earth trembles and he trembles the seas and he opens up this space to expose Rahab. So I should tell you that the other word, way that they use Rahab is as a euphemism for arrogance, pride, independence. And he exposes that on the cross to pull Rahab into that trap, to pull all of the pride of humanity into that trap so that he can kill it and make that space have no obstacle for man and God to work. As you think about it, I'm going to give you a picture of that, but let me just say, what's happening here for Job is, he's beginning, do you remember the very beginning of Job 1? We see that Job is praying for his children just in case they might have cursed God. Mm-hmm. And that gives us a hint that maybe Job thinks God's petty. It doesn't say it right out. We don't know that that's true, but it gives us a hint. As we go along, we realize, oh yeah, Job does think God is petty. But we don't know for sure. This is our second hint that Job just maybe might be beginning to think he doesn't know how God works.
Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, he's going to come right back and go, no, I think I do know how God works. But here's this hint of maybe there's a possibility I don't know all the way God uses his power. This is a beautiful picture of that. The possibility that maybe God's wisdom is directing his power toward Job for some purpose. There might be a purpose. Now, Job is not going to come out and say that, and he's not really going to feel that, but there is that possibility that he might be able to entertain, and it will come. But what I want to do is show you a clip that I think shows this perfectly. So I'm going to warn you, it's a scary movie. It's a monster movie. We're talking about sea creature or the chaos creature, so we're talking about monsters. If I had enough time, I wanted to go out and buy little monsters for everybody because I just thought we have to remember Rahab is chaos, non-order, that's always in the way of God and man coming together, which means it's Egypt. And when we talk about Egypt in the Old Testament, it always talks about the world's way of thinking. And then knowing that it also means arrogance, being independent. So to have that drawn, for God to open, shake everything and draw out Rahab out of us as Christ on the cross, which is where he laser beamed his power, right? Right to Christ on the cross, so that Rahab could be pulled out. So I'm going to show you this clip. I should set it up here. And I'm going to warn you, some of you might want to have seen this movie, and I'm going to spoil it for you. The movie is A Quiet Place. Has anybody seen it?
Mm-hmm. What is it?
A Quiet Place.
Oh, yeah.
So if you want to see it, I'm sorry, because I am going to spoil it for you, because I'm going to show you almost the end. It is probably the best modern picture I've ever seen of Christ and what's happening here. So you have to remember all that we've been through and then think about that. This is one of the things I love to do. I love to read books, watch movies, and go, oh, that's a picture of Christ. Whether they meant it or not, oh, thank you. Also, I thought the electricity went. I don't know. I kind of think so because there's way too many things, and I won't show you everything because there's more to go. Let me set it up. The story is about, apocalyptic times. They live on the earth, but there are these monsters, and the monsters hate noise. That's a quiet place. So all the earth, everybody that's still living on earth, has to keep quiet. They speak in sign language. Because any noise will make the monsters jump out and grab you and kill you.
Great.
So,
and aren't they blind, the monsters? Like, they can't see,
Right, monsters can't see, they can only hear. But Noise bothers them. And so we have at the very beginning of the movie a family of five, a mom and dad, two boys and a girl. And they're leaving, they went to an abandoned store and they got a whole bunch of stuff. And the little boy wants to take this toy airplane. And the father and mother both say, absolutely not, no. And so they all leave and they're walking this path. But the daughter feels sorry for the little boy who didn't get his toy. So she goes and gets that toy and gives him the toy. Okay, that's important. As they're walking and the boy is lagging behind, he presses button on the toy, and it makes noises. Mm-hmm. And so what happens?
He's gone.
He's gone.
You're going to make us watch this. The little boy gets...
No, you're not going to watch that. You're not going to watch that. Yeah. I won't make you watch it. So the little boy is taken. So from that time on, the daughter, of course, feels
terrible.
Yeah. And she then... interprets everything her father does as he blames her.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
And so she's guilty and she feels he does not love her. Mm-hmm. So the whole time. The father, in the meantime, is setting up this whole organization system to help them be alerted when the monsters come. And they've all learned sign language. The daughter, by the way, can't hear, which is probably why she grabbed the toy. And he's been working on hearing aids for her, which is interesting because they don't speak. Anyway, all of that. So we're getting lots of things happen. We're getting to the end of the movie, and the monsters are on their property. And so remember all that you've been told. Girl doesn't feel she's loved by dad. She feels that her dad blames her. So think Job, right? Job hasn't done anything wrong that he knows of, but he feels like God is blaming him. And he feels like God is not good. He doesn't love him. So that's where we're coming. So this is sort of the end of the movie. The monsters have come. Stop. Huh? Why is it not? Oh, I always forget that it doesn't have sound. Remember, there's no sound. So watch. That's why I brought the big one up. So you have to watch the subtitles because they're going to do sign language.
Oh, boy. Can we read them?
Yeah, you can read them.
I
thought there was sound in here. Is there not music in here?
I think there is music.
I know it's really
start loading.
Is it still loading?
Well, you can see the gray part.
Oh, we really need the sound.
Does it usually come, is your computer usually hooked up to speakers, or does it come from...
No, I've been doing this. This is why I don't use this computer anymore, because it's super, super slow. You know what? Are you okay? You okay?
There we go.
Monsters. Let's get to the truck.
In the house.
Power of God's word, laser focused by his wisdom, all of Rahab onto Christ, so that he was sacrificed, so that Rahab could get out of the way, so that arrogance, that independence could get out of the way, so that there would be space for them to go on to live with God. When I looked this up on YouTube, to get this clip, it was interesting to watch read the comments, because so many of the comments were, why did he have to die? They were comments that I've heard over and over again about Christ's crucifixion. Why did he have to die? Because in his wisdom, he lasered his power to pull Rahab out, to pull that arrogance out, so that the space that he originally created for heaven and earth, for God and man to come, could be opened and filled with a place of true relationship. I wish if we're studying Acts, I know, this is the first time I haven't credited it. If we're studying Acts, I would show you the rest of the movie, because it doesn't end there. I mean, talk about, so if you not want to watch the movie, I mean, I don't like monster movies. I think they're silly. This one was this, oh my gosh. Talk about the picture of Christ when he gets up. He's beaten and bloody, and he gets up and he takes the wood. I know. All of that to say, Job is giving us a glimpse, just a glimpse, of what God's power directed by wisdom looks like. It doesn't look like what we want to look like. That's why people say, why does he have to die? So many people commented, well, why didn't he just throw something and the monster could go over that way? Or why didn't he do this and do... No. In his wisdom, he knew that if he focused all of his power through his word, that Rahab would be pulled out. That's what's happening in Job. Is finally Job is coming to the point is, you know what, maybe I don't understand how God's power works with his wisdom. Maybe I don't understand that. Maybe there's an opening for me to think differently about that. We won't see that right away with Job, but it is the hint of the place that Job is entertaining. So, Job's final response to his friends. He gives them advice, and he makes a pledge. And the advice is, stop arguing with me. I am not going to join your false way of living. I am not going to join your team of transactional righteousness. And his pledge is, I am going to maintain my righteousness, even in the face of things I don't understand. I think I understand how God works. Maybe I don't, but it isn't going to change my desire to be in relationship with him, despite my continued suffering. And so the pledge is, I'm not going to be a hypocrite. He says, my lips will not speak wickedness. I'm not going to let my tongue say anything that's not true. My words will align with my behavior. I will not admit that you, friends, are right. I will not let you think you've assessed my character correctly. I am not going to deny my integrity. I still value non-transactional righteousness. I value true relationship. As you can see, I'm not trying to get my stuff back. I don't want something out of this. My conscience will not reproach me because my outward denials don't contradict my inward knowledge, what I know. All of that, I think, is very interesting in the face of this wisdom poem that he's written, to say, I know that God's power is directed by wisdom, and maybe, just maybe, there's purpose in the way he uses his power that I don't understand. It gives just this opening for an Old Testament any person to read and go, is it possible that the shaking up of the seas have a purpose to recede and expose the Rahab in our way of thinking, the Rahab in my way of thinking? Is it possible? There's just this possibility that opens up. Job goes from his pledge to a curse, which is very interesting because, remember, he started with praying for his children who might have cursed, and now he's cursing not God, but he's cursing the friends. He says they're worthless. That is like the New Testament saying, do not say to someone, racha, fool. That means you're worthless, right? Because what is the one major thing an image bearer is supposed to do?
Name worth.
And Job is doing just the opposite. He says, friends, you're enemies. You are wicked, and your teaching is worthless. You are not qualified to be wise men. And his charge against God says, your power has brought disorder in my life. You've treated me as a wicked man, and I still want a hearing. That's how Job ends his charge. So what we have then is we have a summation and a verdict. The friends' testimonies have failed. In series one, we had Job not seduced by the prospect of renewed benefits. I have all this written down so you can just... Series two, Job concludes that the RP system is broken. He wants it to be work, but it's broken. And series three, this series, Job refuses to admit wrongdoing has caused his suffering, and he's not going to be seduced by illegitimate power. Job, as a star witness, has proven that his righteousness is not founded on an expectation of reward. Job has demonstrated that there is such a thing as non-transactional righteousness. And Job has disproven Hasatan's claim that God's policy of rewarding the righteous is counterproductive, because he remains righteous even in the midst of his suffering. So the verdict is, case dismissed. Hasatan, you've lost your case. So then why is there so much more? The problem is, Job's case has not been heard. Remember, Job is bringing a charge against God. And it will be the flip side of Hasatan's. I have for you, and we're not going to go through it, but I have for you a chart that just, I thought, sometimes it's just easier to see it in a chart, what's going on, about how our what we trust in, then informs how we see God and informs how we see circumstances and other people, and then how we actually look at any correctives. So when Scripture wants to correct you in some way that you're thinking is wrong, it has to go through all those pieces, right? Of your view of God is wrong because you're trusting in something that's not God. So look at that chart. That chart kind of just gives a summation of what has been happening in this first half of Job. But we come now to chapter 28. Okay, did you like the fact that you had to write chapter 28?
Yeah.
I think that it really helps us to do that. I had twofold reason for do that. I don't know if most of you know. One of the reasons I had that, I struggled with copyright laws. And although Job fits just in the copyright law that I could actually copyright for you, you can't copyright NAS. It can't contain a whole book. So copyright ways, I couldn't give you the whole book of Job. But I figured writing 28 for yourself and putting it in there would actually give you a better feel for the very center of the book. And remember, it's in chiastic structure, so the center of the book is important. The center of the book tells us what the book is all about, and that is wisdom. So we have then this recess. If you're thinking about the trial along, we have this recess. The case has been dismissed. Hasatan is lost. But there's a new case that came up in the middle of that, so that has to start. But now there's a recess. So Job's case is, while Hasatan is charged that it's bad policy to reward righteous because it would result in only transactional righteousness, case dismissed, Job is charged that it's bad policy to let the righteous suffer because that undermines God's justice. That case will begin after the recess. So that's the case that we're going to deal with from after 28 on. 28 also serves then as this transition place in a couple ways. First, it transitions from the challenger's case to Job's case. Secondly, it shifts focus from justice, which is all the witnesses cared about, right? Justice, to now wisdom. And thirdly, it actually finally gives us a biblical standard for thinking about God and his wisdom. So far, we've had lots of thinking that has been either somewhat on track, really messed up, or completely intertwined with the world thinking. So as a reader, we're going, is this the right way to think or not? I don't know. Finally, in 28, we have, here's one of the ways we can think about God and his wisdom. So it's this. Here's the first standard we have of how to think about God without having to question, is that the right way or the wrong way? So that's what 28 will do for us. It will give us the biblical teaching on how to think rightly about God. So I'm going to give you just a little few application points. We're not going to look at the wisdom chapter until next week. With all that we had, I didn't want to skirt the discussion on the wisdom chapter, so I figured it was more important to get all of those pieces down first. What I want us to think about is, well, if it's true that I often try to justify myself before God, just in those little things, but also in the big things. Remember, Job is preparing us to know how to think rightly about God so that we're prepared when we get to those big issues that Sheila mentioned, like when you lose a child or those huge issues. How then do we think about God? If we haven't prepared, we will default to whatever we have trusted in before, right? We'll default to our systems. We'll default into our picture of God. And that's when it gets really hard because it doesn't fit my picture of God or it doesn't fit my systems. This shouldn't happen. The book of Job is trying to make sure that we understand God well enough to enter those situations where we can begin to say, I don't understand what God's doing here, but I do know God has a purpose. And unlike Job, I need to remember that God is good. right? That's the very first premise we need to know. God is for us. God is good. So avoid justifying ourselves. When God's actions don't make sense, we need to at least give him the benefit of the doubt. Right? We would do that with our child. He makes a huge mistake, or it looks like a huge mistake. We give him the benefit of the doubt. That is what you begin to see with Job. Like, maybe God has a purpose. Maybe God's power isn't just to crush me, but maybe there's something behind it. Secondly, we need to stop our thinking that we can ever do better than God. That I can be more loving than God, that I'm more just than God. And that sounds funny when you say that, right? Who would ever think that they can do better than God? How many of you think you could do better than God at some point in your life? The rest of you are liars. Absolutely we do. We do. And that's one of the things Job is supposed to do. It's supposed to be pulling out your Rahabs, pulling out those places where you have some arrogant thought that, you know, God, anytime I say, really, God?
Yeah.
I think I know better than God, that I could be.
When I'm praying sometimes and I'm just asking God for, you know, to take care of a situation, it's like I tell him how to.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. Exactly right. And we're going to pull to a place of where we could stand instead of that. Because are we going to be confused? Are we going to be frustrated? Yes. Are we going to feel like it's unfair? Yes. Mm-hmm. And Psalms tells us it's okay to say that to God. But Job will show us then what kind of stance we're in.
It's like it's never thought of it that way.
Mm-hmm. I know. That's the point of thinking deeply. What are we actually doing? And the third, so give God the benefit of the doubt. Stop thinking you can do better than God. And thirdly, refuse to pick and choose God's attributes to uphold our systems or our pictures of God. Refuse to be the standard of what is good. All of that involves a process of exposing and examining your thoughts. We're not targeting behavior here, we're targeting thoughts. That's where it all comes from.
Can you say that again, Jill?
Refuse to pick and choose God's attributes to uphold your system or your picture of him. Like, he's got to be just here. He's got to be loving here. Refuse to make yourself the standard of what is good. Before we end with our verse and our prayer, are there any questions? Have I muddled the waters, or have I helped clarify them a bit? Yeah, the seas are right churning up, right? I personally think that's very helpful to know the seas churning up is to get them to recede and expose. That's purposeful, right, for God to use his power that way. Anybody questions? Anybody?
Carolyn? Not really a question, but you wanted us to write the chapter 28 out. What version, really?
Whatever one you want.
Yeah, you can write whatever one you want. We use the NAS because word for word, it's the most accurate. ESV is comparable. The rest are phrase for phrase. So that's why we use NAS when we study. But as far as writing it out to help you understand it a little bit more, you can use anything you want. You could use the Message, which I bet no one chose to do because...
I did.
Oh, you did?
I wrote it out twice. I wrote it out in the NIV and the Message.
That's a great thing.
I like the way the Message expands on...
Yes, yes. I didn't think anyone would choose that because it's a lot longer, right? Because it expands. But I actually think that that helps you to get a little piece.
Eugene Peterson. It's longer, actually. I got them both.
Oh, good. I think it's very helpful. I did say that you could type it out.
I type on paper.
Just so you know, depending on your age, writing will get you better than typing. But for those of you who have grown up with computers, so those of you who are young enough that you've always had computers around, your brain has actually evolved to typing doing the same as writing for us.
Oh, wow.
Which is interesting. Yeah. Jed.
So, just, I need a little clarification.
Okay.
So, Bildad, Eliphaz, and Zophar, they are the wise men, obviously. So, they are of the world. They're the Aeonian people. But yet, they can speak wisdom to Job on the RP because they just know of it, or they're just, I mean.
So, here's the interesting. Remember, it's written actually to Israel, right? So the writer uses that to make Israel realize you use the great symbiosis just as much as the world does, and the world uses the retribution principle also. So there is this rhetorical use of the world and Job like as Israel that you can't see any clear definition between the two, right? Because they give stuff from both. Which is, so if we're thinking about it from the church's point of view, and we're reading it that way, the author would be saying to us, right now, do you see a lot of clear delineation between the church, what they trust in, and what the world trusts in? Yeah. And that's what's happening, is there, you're not supposed to have a clear delineation because we just operate that way. Mm-hmm. We don't have a clear. We should look completely different, and we don't. Does that help, Jen?
Yes.
Okay. Anybody else? All right, let's say our verse. Job 42:2.
I know that you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted.
Job 42:2. Now, listening to that verse, you have a little bit more idea of why we would choose that verse. No purpose of yours can be thwarted, even though getting to that purpose looks chaotic, right? But your purpose is always to make space for God and man to relate with one another. Almighty God, to whom all hearts are open, all desires known, and from you no secrets are hid, cleanse the thoughts of our hearts by the inspiration of your Holy Spirit, that we may perfectly love you and worthily magnify your holy name, through Christ our Lord. Amen. All right. So hopefully all of you are staying for lunch.